paved with marble and purple crystal and mother of pearl. The servants were told to keep everyone's cups full, as much wine as anyone wanted. Now, during this party, several chalices in, the king calls for his queen, Queen Vashti. Queen Vashti was beautiful, and the king wanted everyone to see her. Now, I don't know why. Maybe because he was drunk, maybe because she didn't want to be shown off like a prized possession. Whatever the reason, maybe it was another reason, the queen refused to come when the king's servants called for her. And this infuriated the king. The other men who advised the king, they also got worried. They worried that Queen Vashti's refusal might inspire a rebellion among all the women in the 127 provinces that this king ruled over. Soon, wives everywhere would be refusing their husbands. Think about that big territory. That would be a problem, they felt. And so a royal order went out to the whole territory, saying that each husband should rule over his own house. Sometime later, when the king wasn't so angry, but still wanted to replace the queen, his young male servants came up with a plan. Now, I'm not trying to rag on all the young men here, but this plan was a plan that really only young men could have come up with. They say, "Hey, king, we've got an idea. Why don't you hold a search for the most beautiful young unmarried women in all of your territory? You see the map? It's a big territory. There's got to be a lot of beautiful young women in this territory." And so they say, "Choose servants in each of your provinces and have them lead the search. And then bring all the beautiful young women here and have your servants give them all makeovers. And then see which one pleases you the most and make her your new queen." Kind of sounds to me like a Bible Times reality show. I mean, can you imagine it? Of course, the king liked this plan. And I imagine the young servants thought they might get some benefit out of it as well. Now, we have not even gotten to the part of the story where Esther comes in, but this is important for setting the stage. First, because it helps us understand how and why Esther becomes queen. But perhaps even more importantly for us, it gives us the context in which Esther acts. Sometimes the place that we find ourselves, the place where God is going to use us, is a place where it looks like you're on the bottom, where you seem powerless. Yes, Esther was queen. She becomes queen. But she still, as we've already seen, doesn't have a lot of power. The queens didn't really share in the decision-making in the kingdom. And the queen, it really seems, was just there to please the king, to be his beautiful wife. But just like Esther, with faithfulness and with prayer, God can use even the ones that seem weakest, that seem to have no power in the system to do great things, even to save a whole people. And so when we feel like we are caught in a system that oppresses us, or like we are on the bottom and have no hope of making a difference in the world, we can take courage and keep the faith. God's power and strength are shown in weakness. Now, just after this scene is where we do get to Esther's entrance into the story. Esther lived in Susa, the king's city. She'd been raised by her cousin Mordecai, a Jew, for she was an orphan. Esther was beautiful, and so when they started searching for all the beautiful young women, Esther was sent to the palace for 12 months of beauty treatments. Before she went, Mordecai told her, "Don't tell anyone about your family background or your race." For he knew that being a Jew in the Persian Empire as exiles was a difficult thing. But Esther quickly became a favorite of the one who was in charge of all of these young women. And when the time came for Esther to go into the king, he loved her more than all of the other women. And he made her queen in place of Vashti. He threw a big feast and declared a public holiday. Now Mordecai, remember, Mordecai's her cousin, who's like her father, he was working at the king's gate. From there, he was able to kind of keep tabs on Esther and even send her messages back and forth. And Esther did everything that Mordecai told her to do. When two of the king's servants were plotting to kill the king, Mordecai caught wind of it, and he told Esther, who told the king. When they investigated and found it true, the king had those two servants impaled on poles. Now, some time after that is when Haman comes into the story. Haman was appointed as the king's top official. Each day, when he passed through the king's gate, all those working at the gate were supposed to kneel or bow down to Haman, as the king had ordered. But Mordecai did not, because he was Jewish. The other workers would ask him about it every day, and eventually they told Haman. And this made him mad, so mad that he wanted to kill Mordecai. Not just Mordecai, though. He wanted to wipe out all of the Jews in the kingdom. This is how Haman presented his plan. You can read it in Esther 3:8. He said that to the king, "A certain group of people exist in pockets among the other peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of everyone else, and they refuse to obey the king's laws. There's no good reason for the king to put up with them any longer. If the king wishes, let a written order be sent out to destroy them, and I will hand over 10,000 kikars of silver to those in charge of the king's business. The silver can go into the king's treasuries." Does it sound familiar? Even back then, we had corruption and those who wanted to twist reality and wipe a people out. The king, hearing Haman's plan, removed his royal ring from his finger and handed it to Haman, saying, "Both the money and the people are under your power. Do as you like with them." So Haman had a decree written, sealed with his ring, the king's ring, and runners took it all over that large territory, from India to Egypt. The decree was an order for genocide. It instructed the people to wipe out, to kill, to destroy all the Jews, men, women, and children. It ordered this to happen on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, and it ordered all their property could also be taken. It went out, sending the city where the king lived into total shock, while the king and Haman sat down for a drink, the scriptures say. So now we're beginning to see some of the details that they don't tell you in the Bible, the children's Bible version. We see that there have been, throughout history, those who are both unwilling to compromise their faith and those who don't like that and who want to bring down the faithful. But Scripture shows us time and again that although persecution may cause us to suffer, that God will ultimately give honor to those who are faithful, even when it means risking or losing their lives. Now, back to the story. When Mordecai heard the news, he tore his clothes, he put on mourning clothes, and put ashes on his head. Jews all over the kingdom did the same, crying bitterly in the streets. Esther sends word to him, trying to console him. She doesn't know what's happened, but Mordecai tells everything to the servant and gives her a copy of the decree to read. Asks her to go to the king and seek his kindness and help for her people. Esther's message back to Mordecai says, "Everyone knows that the law is that any man or woman who comes to the king in the inner courtyard without being called is to be put to death. Only the person to whom the king holds out the gold scepter may live. And I have not been called to the king for the past 30 days. Mordecai now is kind of getting a sense that maybe Esther thinks she's going to be protected there in the palace, that she won't be under threat from this decree. And so he sends back these words, perhaps the most famous words from Esther. He says, "Don't think for one minute that unlike all the other Jews, you'll come out of this alive simply because you are in the palace. In fact, if you don't speak up at this very important time, relief and rescue will appear for the Jews from another place. But you and your family will die. But who knows? Maybe it was for a moment like that you came to be part of the royal family." Now, I find it amazing what great faith Mordecai has that God will not let his people, the Jews, be wiped out. Even if Mordecai's own family is destroyed, he knows that God will provide a way out for his people. He trusts God's promises to Israel. Esther sends back word, asking Mordecai to gather all the people, like we heard in the Bible, the children's Bible story, to fast for 3 days. And then 3 days later, she puts on royal clothes, goes to stand in the inner courtyard, and the king notices her from her throne. You know, God doesn't actually appear anywhere in the book of Esther mentioned by name, but woven throughout, we find these examples where we, looking back, can kind of see, surely this was God's hand in this story. So when Esther comes out into the inner courtyard, the king notices her and holds out the gold scepter, signaling her to enter. She won't be killed for coming to the king uncalled for. She comes forward and asks, and he asks, "What is it, Queen Esther? What do you want? I'll give you anything, even half of the kingdom." Now, if any of you have ever been in a situation where you had to survive in a system that didn't make it easy for you, you probably learned some ways of subversion, ways of working the system, whether that was a big institutional system or just learning to kind of get what you want from your parents or from others with power. Even though Esther has the king's favor, and he's saying that he'll give her anything she wants, Esther doesn't come right out and say what she's thinking. Not right away. Instead, she decides to throw him a party. She says, "If the king wishes, please come today with Haman for this feast that I have prepared for you." They go to the feast, and he asks her again, "What do you want?" But still, the timing's not right. She asks them to come to another feast tomorrow, says then she'll be ready to answer. Now, Haman, he leaves happy. He's been invited to a personal party with the king and the queen. But on the way home, he passes Mordecai. Remember, Mordecai is the one who's still refusing to bow and honor Haman because he wants to bow and honor only God. And seeing Mordecai not bow to him ruins Haman's good mood. At home, he calls all his friends together, and probably to make himself feel better, he boasts about his wealth, his many sons, how the king had promoted him to the top post. And he says, "Best of all, Queen Esther has invited no one else but me to join her and the king for a feast she's prepared. In fact, I've been called to join them again tomorrow at their place." But all of this, he says, loses its meaning every time I see Mordecai, the Jew, sitting at the king's gate. Can you relate to that? Here Haman seems to have it all going for him, but still he is not happy. He blames it on that one guy, Mordecai, who ruins it every time. But really, I get the sense that it's his pride that is causing him to be unhappy. He can't stand that there's someone who doesn't honor him the way he thinks everyone should. And so his wife and his friends tell him, "Well, why don't you have a big 70-foot-high pole built? And in the morning, go tell the king to have Mordecai impaled on it." That doesn't really make the children's Bible version either. "Then," she says, "then you can go to the king and the king's feast in a happy mood." He likes this idea. He has the pole prepared. And the next part of this story, if you remember it, has all these great dramatic twists. If I remember right from English class, I think it's dramatic irony, where we know what's going to happen, but he doesn't. So that same night, while Haman's making this plan to have the big pole, the king in his castle cannot sleep. And I guess he sort of thought this was a good bedtime story. He asks his servants to just read to him from the royal records, just reading about all the things that have happened in the past as he's been king. And so as they're reading, they get to that part where Mordecai saved the king's life, where he told Esther to tell him about the plot that two of his servants were going to kill the king. And the king says, "Hey, what did we do to honor Mordecai for that? I mean, he saved my life. Did we give him anything special?" And the servants say, "No, we did nothing." And so just then, Haman's coming into the courtyard, coming to say that the king needs to have Mordecai killed, impaled on the pole. And the king sees Haman and tells him to come in. And he asks him, "What should be done for the man who the king really wants to honor?" Of course, Haman, being full of pride, assumes that the king wants to honor him. And so he says, here's what the king should do. Have the king's servants bring a royal robe that the king has worn, a horse that the king has ridden, even with a royal crest on its head. Hand over the robe and horse to one of the king's officials and have them personally robe the man that the king wants to honor. And lead him out on the horse into the city square, saying, this is what the king does for the man he really wants to honor. Then, of course, the king says to Haman, hurry, take the robe and the horse just as you've said, and do exactly that for Mordecai, the Jew, who works at the king's gate. Don't leave out a single thing that you've said. Haman has no choice but to just do as the king says. After he's done it, Haman goes home ashamed, while Mordecai simply returns to work at the king's gate. That night, again, there is the feast, Haman, Esther, and the king. And again, the king asks Esther what she wants, anything he'd give her. And she answers, if I please the king, and if the king wishes, give me my life. That's my wish, and the lives of my people too. That's my desire. We have been sold, I and my people, to be wiped out, killed, destroyed. If we simply had been sold as male and female slaves, I would have said nothing, but no enemy can compensate the king for this kind of damage. The king is surprised. Remember, he doesn't know that she is Jewish. He says, who is this person and where is he? Who would dare do such a thing? And she replies, a man who hates an enemy, the wicked Haman. Haman, of course, is terrified, and the king is furious. And eventually, Haman ends up being the one who is impaled on the 75-foot pole. And Mordecai and Esther inherit all that Haman had before. Now, Esther knew that even with this turn of events, the decree still stood. So she asks the king that the Jews might be able to defend themselves on the 13th day of the 12th month. And so when the day came, the Jews defended themselves, and in fact, no one could stand against them. So that is just about the whole story of Esther. But I want you to know that there is still more to the story. Because what was true for Esther is true for each and every one of you. God might not have a plan to save a whole people from genocide through you, or maybe God does. I do not know where all God might lead you. But I do know that God can use any encounter to reveal the good news of God's hope for the world. And it can be in ways that seem small or ways that seem big. Many of you know that last month I went to Portland to participate in General Conference, the meeting of the United Methodist Church and United Methodists from all over the world that happens every 4 years. Leading up to General Conference, a lot of kids and a few adults from our church made some cards, little handmade cards that showed God's love. And with those, they raised some money. And this was for a project called GC for JC that sent General Conference delegates and visitors out into the city of Portland to meet Jesus and the people who literally call the streets of Portland home. I hope that some of you maybe saw on Facebook some of the stories of those encounters. This morning, I want to share with you one of the stories of a woman named Leanne from Mississippi who was at General Conference and who shared her story. And I have to wonder if maybe the reason that God sent Leanne to Portland was for such a time as this, when she met a man named Mike. Listen to Leanne's story as she wrote it in a Facebook post. She writes, "So here I am, all the way over in Portland, and I am what they call a reserve delegate, meaning that I wait in the wings until one of the delegates needs a break or have meetings that conflict with each other. Yesterday, I met some cool people, and they told me about a project called GC for JC, which includes providing handmade greeting cards made by kids attached to a gift card to a local restaurant that practices a pay-as-you-can model of community living. They've created a map of Portland that includes neighborhoods with disenfranchised and houseless folks so that as we tour Portland, we might share the good news with a tangible witness of a sweet greeting from a child and resources to share a hot meal. Today, I wasn't able to find a seat in one of the meetings, so I found a laptop counter for charging phones and such that was out of the way. I plugged in, logged in, and settled in for a quiet hour. About that time, a guy sat next to me and asked if he could charge his phone too. Sure, wasn't my wall. Then he said, "Are you going to the church that's here today?" I was inclined to answer, "Why? What have you heard?" Instead, I said, "Yes, I'm a part of these meetings." He said, "What are you all meeting about?" I said, "We're meeting to make rules about who can lead our churches, when and where they can lead our churches, and what they can do once they become leaders of our churches." He asked if I was trying to become a leader, and I said, "I already am." "You're a priest?" He was a little surprised. I asked if he went to church anywhere, and he laughed and said, "Do I look like I go to church? No, I haven't been to church in a while." "Well, if you went to church, where would you go?" He named a place. "Well, what keeps you from going there?" He said, "Because going there doesn't change anything for me. My life still has problems. I ask God to help my problems, but I got worse problems. So I just do my life. And sometimes I have too much fun, you know? And sometimes I get in trouble. But whatever, it's my life." "So did you expect God to fix your problems when you prayed?" I said, "No, I mean, I made those choices. I got to take responsibility for my life, you know? But God doesn't make things easier. It would be harder to try to be all good and stuff for God." "Well, what if God just wanted to forgive you and be your friend?" There was silence. "What if God just wanted to forgive you and be your friend?" "I don't even know what to think about that. Forgive me for what?" "Well, you just said that you have to take responsibility for your actions. What if God could take away those feelings of shame and regret that you carry?" "That would be cool, but then I would have to be all good, and actually sometimes I enjoy the mess I get into." He didn't say mess. "What if when you start living with God instead of without God, you find new stuff, and that was cool stuff, and you realize that the mess you liked before was just mess?" I didn't say mess either. We laughed. "So, like, how would I even do that?" "Well, you could pray something like, 'God, today I want to go with you. Would you go with me? God, I want my life to be more about you. Would you help my life be less messy?'" "I can't pray that. I wouldn't mean it. Plus, how do I go with God? I can't see God." There was silence for a moment. And then he said, "I guess I can see God in you. Do you pray?" "Yes, I pray. Can I pray for you right now?" "Yes, but can I keep my eyes open?" We laughed. And then after we prayed, he said, "Wow, so that was cool. Better than I thought. It actually feels kind of warm." And he pointed to his chest. I said, "Can I pray for you tomorrow?" "Yeah, I mean, sure." "Can I ask some of my friends to pray for you too?" "I don't know anyone who would pray for me, but yeah." And so Mike left, headed back out onto the street. His phone got charged up. He now has a cute card on pink construction paper and a gift card for a hot meal at a super cool restaurant where I'm guessing God has some more divine appointments for him. Hashtag what I'm learning at General Conference 2016. Hashtag pray for Mike. Leanne didn't set out that day necessarily knowing that she was going to help someone better understand God's love for them. But when she found herself at the right place, at the right time, she became aware of that opportunity. So with the Spirit's leading, she let God speak through her and to her. She and Mike were both transformed by the experience. Can you imagine a way that God might want to speak to and through you in something as simple as a conversation with a stranger when you're expecting to just be waiting around, or an interaction at the park or the soccer field or the coffee shop. This week, as our church led Cave Quest VBS, I got to spend some time with some of the fourth through sixth graders. And as I was with them on Tuesday, we rotated through prayer stations, talking about how Jesus gives us courage and direction. We prayed and thought about who might feel excluded and how we could show God's welcome and love to them. We read the story of the feeding of the 5,000 and thought about situations where God might be calling us to give something, to help provide food or clean water or clothes or meet other needs. We wrote and drew pictures of courageous acts of kindness, ways God might want us to serve family and friends or strangers. I was touched and inspired by these kids' hearts to reach out, to serve, to know that they too had an important part of our story and had important work that God was calling them to do. I mean, we heard about the money they raised over Vacation Bible School, and I do think that one of the gifts of this church is the way that we believe next generation now, as Vern said, that our children do lead us individually and as a church. Esther reminds us that Esther reminds us of the courage that God gives us in accomplishing God's work. While Esther's story is one of risking her individual life for the sake of her family and people, Christ calls us even further. You know, it's always a risk that the people called church will develop a kind of compound mentality where we simply gather for refuge as fearful people believing that the world is out to get us. But this is not what God's resurrection is about. This is not what God calls the church to be. Seeing the brave, loving life of our Savior's sacrificial death, the way of resurrection in the early church, that teaches us that God's cause cannot be defeated by sin and evil, even when it seems to be so. Jesus is, in fact, the one who defeated sin and evil. As we read in 1 John 4:4, "You, dear children, are from God and have overcome them, because the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world." This week, I got to meet an amazing group of leaders who are here in Boone participating in the Mandela Washington Fellows Program for 6 weeks at Appalachian State. I'm so excited that a couple of them are with us here this morning. These men and women have traveled here from all across Africa to learn and to study and to take back ideas to apply to the amazing work that they are already doing in their home countries. As part of the program, each fellow is matched with a peer mentor, someone from here doing work in a similar field, to share ideas and offer mutual encouragement and insight. So on Wednesday, I got to meet Francis, who works for the Anglican Church in Zanzibar, the coastal islands off of Tanzania. Francis grew up Christian in a place where Christians are a very small minority. He shared how Christians in Zanzibar are often discriminated against in school, in business, in daily life. He talked about how politicians in his home country have used religion to pit Muslims and Christians against each other, and it has led to persecution, including many churches being burned and priests being shot. But still, this did not stop the church from being the church and doing what the church is called to do. When Francis was in high school, he got a scholarship and eventually was chosen to go to university on a full ride, under the condition that he would return to Zanzibar and work for the church. He now directs the outreach programs of the Anglican Church in Zanzibar. And he told me about one of the projects they've been doing there recently. The project reaches out to those whom he called the marginalized, such as commercial sex workers, drug users who are addicted to injection drugs. In their community, these groups suffer from higher than usual rates of HIV infection. And so the church started a program educating them about HIV and AIDS to try to help them prevent its spread. But as they talked with them, they realized that these groups were, many of them felt forced into their situation because of the economic situation, that they weren't able to find jobs. Poverty was a root cause. And so the churches came together and began offering training programs in entrepreneurship They asked them what kinds of businesses they would like to be in, and they began giving them skills in those areas. For those who were committed to working towards a new life, they began giving microloans, which would be repaid to help others in the community start new businesses. It's been a great success. What amazing things God is doing through them, giving hope and helping those who have been sex workers and drug addicts to find new life by starting their own businesses and in some cases coming to faith in Christ. This story is not just about Francis being in the right place at the right time, but a whole church, several parishes, realizing that perhaps God has them where they are, even in the midst of persecution, to come and do a great thing, not just to sing praises on Sunday morning, but to transform the lives of those whom society and even the church marginalizes. I hope that you are inspired, like I was, hearing the stories of Leanne and Francis and the ministry that they've been involved in. But I hope that you don't leave here just thinking, gee, I sure am glad that God still uses people to do great things, or wow, isn't it nice that those people really listened and followed God? No, I hope that these stories inspire you to think about how God wants to work through you, right where you are, at this time in your life. Maybe it will be something that seems small, like an unexpected conversation. Maybe it will be something that becomes your life's work, transforming lives and communities, helping people discover the abundant life that God has for them. Maybe you'll know early on that it's what God's calling you to do, or maybe you'll only know looking back after it's done. Or maybe when someone who serves as a Mordecai in your life comes and brings it to your attention. Maybe it'll be when you're in a place of leadership and power, or maybe it will be when all the odds seem against you, like they did for Esther. But hopefully, like Esther, we can be prepared. We can prepare with fasting and praying and the support of the faithful family of God. Whatever the situation, we can take courage. Jesus stands ready to equip us. The Spirit is with you to strengthen you, and God will deliver you through whatever it is that God calls you to do in such a time as this. Thanks be to God. Amen.